This is Dave Gahary reporting from the corner of Wall and Fraud. The great stock market crash of 1929 introduced regulation and accountability to an industry who preferred none, and they still prefer none. In 1934, Congress passed the Securities Exchange Act, creating the Securities and Exchange Commission, known as the SEC, for the purposes of protecting the uninformed, innocent individual investor not privy to Wall Street's inside information. In theory, the idea of a national securities regulator, the top cop of stocks, shall we say, sounded like a necessary component to ensure that your average investor got a fair shake. The reality, unfortunately, is not so sanguine. In fact, my guest, who's on the hold right now on the phone for today's show, is a former SEC senior counsel who, after leaving the government's employ, started a website designed to educate the individual investor who, according to him, is not served as well as they might think. The website's called realityatthesec.com, and when you first sign on to it through the internet, you'll be greeted by what looks like an official notice from an organization like the Securities and Exchange Commission. It says, "This is not the official website of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. On the contrary, it is the website of the SEC's loyal opposition. It is dedicated to examining the reality of the SEC's enforcement of the federal securities laws, to educating the public about those laws and their violation, and to help defrauded investors understand what has happened to them." And you have a choice. You can either go to that website, or he says, if you would rather read the SEC's typical self-serving propaganda, where, for example, they never mention a case they lost, you can go to their official website. We're going to go to realityofthesec.com with attorney Gary Goodnow. Gary, are you there?
Yes, I am. Dave, how are you?
All right. Thanks for joining. You're down in Florida, is that correct?
Yes, in Miami, Florida.
How is it down there?
Well, we're having torrential rains, which doesn't bode well for tonight's Monday Night Football.
That's great. Gary, you know, your website, realityofthesec.com, when it first came online in August of this year, was a real eye-opener to a lot of people, because you are, or you were, a former Securities and Exchange Commission senior counsel down at the Miami office. Can you explain a little bit about what your duties were down there?
Yes. By the time I left the SEC in Miami, I was in management, and I was in charge of what was called the New Matter Committee. That meant that all of the leads and tips and complaints and articles in the newspaper or whatever that reported securities fraud in our area, the southeast of the United States, came to my desk, and I had to triage them, so to speak, to use the term from the medical profession. And that meant that because we had limited resources, I had to decide which cases we were going to pay attention to and possibly bring enforcement action.
Right. And your whole premise of your website is that the SEC doesn't really pay attention to the important cases. Is that correct?
Well, they do pay attention to certain important cases. And there have been certain very important prosecutions under the federal securities laws, but owing to a lack of resources and owing to the fact that they only bring civil and not criminal remedies to bear against the violators, I try and show at my website that Americans really can't consider that there is a cop on the beat.
They can't consider.
Right. I don't think they should consider that there is anything more than a very, very thin line trying to maintain the integrity of the market system. You have what arguably greatest economy in the history of the world, and basically it is regulated by about 300 to 400 enforcement actions that are brought a year, and that's it.
Mr. Goodnow, this is Sharan Harper.
Hi.
How are you this morning?
Fine, thank you.
Good. If the SEC's enforcement abilities can only bring civil action and not criminal action, what then is the consequence for violators?
Sometimes very little. It really depends on how well the violator has planned for any kind of an attack from the SEC. The unfortunate typical situation that I ran into was that the SEC would bring a civil action, and under an SEC rule, the defendant can consent without admitting or denying the allegations of the complaint, and there's an injunction put in place that basically says obey the law or else you'll be held in contempt of court. And then as far as disgorging any of the ill-gotten gains, all the defendant has to say is, well, I don't have them anymore. And what's really amazing is the SEC that sues these people based on the allegation that they are absolute crooks and can't be trusted to tell the truth, they then trust the crook to sign an affidavit saying that they don't have any money, and then the SEC will enter into a stipulated judgment whereby the disgorgement of the ill-gotten gains is waived, called a waiver, based on what they call a demonstrated inability to pay. And that was what was the worst for me, was to watch people commit egregious fraud against unsuspecting people with their hard-earned money, or money that was important to them because they were a widow or an orphan or a victim of a tort, maybe they had a judgment or something like that, and then the violator would basically, well, in many instances, go on to the next fraud.
Wouldn't it be to his advantage to send now and pay later if the payment is so low?
The payment is typically not low. The judgment against them could be for millions and millions of dollars. And what you'll see on the SEC website is our press releases heralding that we have a judgment against this gentleman for millions and millions of dollars. But they don't pay the millions and millions of dollars. All they say is, I don't have the money. Mm-hmm. And the SEC line staff attorneys are under pressure to move on to the next case. So they settle the whole thing with a waiver.
Right, and the office that you're in, Gary, was, in your words, the most productive in the country.
Yeah, when I was there, by productive, I mean in terms of the resources we had, the attorneys that we had, and the cases that we brought, and the amount of money we recovered for investors, we were the top a couple years there. And as a matter of fact, we had been, the Miami office was a subset originally of the Atlanta office, which was the regional office, and Chairman Arthur Levitt changed that. He made Miami the regional office and the Atlanta office the district office. It was kind of like on a fence. They used to say bottom rail, now on top.
Right.
And that was because we were just bringing so much more with so much less.
Right, and of course, as I told you, Arthur Levitt was on here a couple of weeks ago, and you told me when we spoke over the weekend that you had some lunch with him at a Hard Rock Cafe. That was down in Florida?
Yes, right. Yes, right after he became the chairman, which was kind of an exciting time because President Clinton had just gotten elected and Vice President Gore was talking about reinventing government. The chairman came down and he hosted some attorneys at the Hard Rock Cafe because I'm not quite sure on it, but his son, I believe, is involved at the Hard Rock Cafe.
He was a waiter.
Well, we sat and I was fortunate to sit close to him, and he really created an important idealism for me, because he was going to take care of it. He was really going to clean up the street, because he had been a broker for many, many years, and he had first-hand knowledge of some of the seamy sides of it.
Right.
And that was exciting.
Right. Yeah, he did detail that. Bernard, did you want
to? Well, I was just saying that President Bush is supposed to name his new economic team today, and I'm wondering what does that portend for Wall Street?
Wow, it's really going to depend on who he picks, but I don't have a lot of confidence, unfortunately. I wish that I did. Some of the names that they have been floating...
come right from Wall Street.
Yes, and one of them, Senator Phil Graham, I'm just amazed at that, because the senator's wife was on in a leadership position at the CFTC, that's when they gave exemption to Enron that provided for some of those energy deals to not be treated with tougher regulation, and you ended up with off-the-books accounting on that, while her husband was chairman of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and getting $200,000 a year from Enron. I don't think that's the type of person that will give the people the confidence. Right now we're having a crisis of confidence, if anything. And for the first time, as I understand it, in 100 years, and even longer, our economy is looking at the possibility of deflation. Not inflation, deflation.
Right.
And John Maynard Keynes argued in the 1920s that in a modern industrial society, deflation was impossible. That there would only be inflation, it was just a question of how much each year. And now we are staring at the abyss in terms of how low interest rates have been brought down by Mr. Greenspan. And so I fear for a confidence crisis, especially if we're going to pay for a war.
Right, a war that probably isn't necessary.
Well, no matter how you feel about it, the war, you have to be honest about how we're going to pay for it. We're not going to have the local Arab countries, like the Saudis or the Kuwaitis, pay for it, like they paid for a great bit of the last President Bush's Iraq war.
Right.
And the president is very disinclined to raise taxes, and we don't have Japanese and German money coming into our country the way it was, because of course the Japanese market is pretty much shot, because it was all based on speculative real estate at the end of the day, and I just don't know how we're going to pay for the war.
Right, so not much confidence. Let me say again that we're speaking with Gary Goodnow, former Securities and Exchange Commission senior counsel, who is now practicing law privately in Florida. Gary, you said that there's two classes in the Securities and Exchange Commission themselves,
yes.
New York City and Washington, D.C. And, of course, there are the other regions throughout the country which bring, as you said, 90% of the enforcement cases are generated in the regions. But New York City and Washington, D.C., they cherry-pick the cases. Is that correct?
Yes. The home office, the Washington office, has the right to take any case from any regional office. The theory is that they have the resources far and above any regional office. The New York office has first priority for any of the cases arising out of Wall Street.
Right.
But there's really two classes or two cultures within the SEC. There's the New York Washington axis, which consists of people who are going to leave the SEC and work for the brokerage firms in New York or the major law firms both in New York and Washington. And that's a level of SEC practice that is very political, and it's very much the government-private sector revolving door. And I should add that there's another aspect to it. A lot of them go to work for the NASD or the New York Stock Exchange Regulation,
right,
or the American Stock Exchange Enforcement Groups. And then there's the rest of the SEC.
Right, like you.
Yeah, the rest of the Division of Enforcement. And we were the people who actually were dealing with the cases that they didn't want, but the cases that had to be brought if the SEC was going to at least have some deterrent effect through the publicity that journalists like yourself would bring to make the public aware of that there is at least some possibility you're going to suffer some way,
right,
if you perpetrate a fraud. And that class difference was incredible, because I would go to these conferences and I would talk about issues dealing with, you know, the widows and orphans, so to speak, and the people, some of the people at least, from the New York Washington Axis, they had no interest in that at all. I mean, they were thinking about, you know, what was important as to changing some kind of esoteric regulation on the New York Stock Exchange and how it was going to impact Merrill Lynch.
Right, so it's kind of like... We brought up Charles Senator,
right,
who was your boss, and of course you told me the story about how he somehow wanted to get to Italy to meet the Pope through his connections with the SEC. What was that about again?
Well, what happened, as I said, was that Miami became a regional office.
Right.
And that meant being head of that, in charge of that office was a real plum. It was a real high salary and all that.
Right.
And high visibility. And the person that I had worked for, Charlie Harper, who was a government servant for 22 years, he didn't get the job. The job went to this guy, Chuck Senator. And I remember being in a meeting with Chuck, and he was discussing hiring a very qualified attorney in terms of the gentleman's legal ability. But Chuck blurted out, well, this lawyer's father is the ambassador to Italy, and I really think we should hire him because, for among other reasons, I hope he can arrange through his father, the ambassador, that my mother can meet the Pope.
Unbelievable. And he may have done that, actually, as you said. So it seems like the D.C. and the New York crew, they're more concerned about the political connections and what door they're going to revolve out of, where they're going to work. And the regional offices, where 90% of the cases are generated, where you were at, you guys are down in the trenches doing all the work. Gary, I want to appreciate you so much for coming on today and sharing your insight with us. Again, that's reality@thesec.com. There's a lot of free information on there for the individual investor, so much so that several securities lawyers have contacted Gary, and they're angered that he has given away this information for free. This is what they get paid for. Gary, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm at your disposal.